Thank you. David, would you please call the case and call us to order?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Conley, Judge Larkin, Judge Eade, the Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. This is our Zoom oral arguments today on Tuesday, October 29th. We have four cases today. As all people are aware, this is being live streamed. And in addition, the audio version will be available tomorrow. However, our rules do prohibit for anyone making their own private copies, so we would ask you to respect that. Our first case this morning is A24-0289, the State of Minnesota versus James Dolan. Appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may begin.
Good morning. I'm Peter Dahlquist. I represent the appellant. Is my volume setting fine?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. Good morning. I represent the appellant, as I stated in this matter, Mr. Dahlin. Mr. Dahlin was arrested on April 3rd of 2023. He was ultimately charged with drug possession following the stop of his vehicle in Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. He moved to suppress the evidence, arguing several grounds. One is that the traffic stop was not supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion. And then secondly, that the subsequent search of his vehicle was a violation of his constitutional rights under the US and Minnesota constitutions to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The court held a contested omnibus hearing. The matter was submitted solely on the records of a Florence packet, which has contained an in index number 22 of the court record. The court ultimately found that the stop was supported by reasonable, articulable suspicion, and further that the search was pursuant to two different exceptions to the warrant requirement. The first was that it was an automobile exception or the probable cause exception, and the second was that it was pursuant to the protective weapons sweep exception, allowing officers to sweep the vehicle. One thing that I think is important to highlight, just at the outset of this argument, is that those two exceptions contain kind of an inherent tension between the two. The probable cause exception requires that there's a fair probability of contraband or evidence of a crime that will be found in the place to be searched, while the protective weapons search is predicated on, and the district court found that Mr. Dahlin was not committing a crime, but was rather going to be returned to the vehicle and processed for an equipment violation and a traffic violation and ultimately released. So there's a tension between those two
Is
exceptions.
that what the district court found, though? I thought that the district court reasoned that if he were returned to the car and there were a weapon in the car, then it could present a safety issue for the law enforcement that was on the scene. I don't know that the district court actually affirmatively found that at that point in the encounter, your client was necessarily going to be released.
The district court did affirmatively find in its order that he was going to be returned to the vehicle because he was being investigated for a minor traffic offense. The district court did ultimately find that. I think in its order it explicitly found that. It kind of goes in a very specific progression that the district court does in its order and finds that initially the search was supported because of the protective weapon search was supported by that reason, but then it also found that the probable cause was supported by two different factors. One was the indication of drug use, and then secondly was the odor of marijuana. So I'm getting a little, I'm sorry if that did or did not answer your question.
I'm looking at the order to double check what the finding was, but I also don't know that there's necessarily this tension. I mean, just because someone has probable cause to search, an officer has probable cause to search a vehicle, doesn't mean they're necessarily going to find anything in the vehicle and then arrest the suspect in that situation, right? I mean, I think you're presuming that with the automobile exception, that that's necessarily going to lead to the discovery of contraband. and it's not certainty that's needed there, right? It's just probable cause. And a lot of times there's a probable cause search that's done and nothing shows up, and then the person is can be released. So I don't see the, I don't see the tension that you're pointing to here.
And I think the tension's a little bit more case by case, and it's specific to this. So I would agree with you, not in every case is that tension explicitly or implicitly present. But I think in this case specifically, when the court goes out of its way to say, you know, it says explicitly what probable cause is based upon, but then it also goes and explicitly says what the protective weapon search is based upon, the two are inconsistent here.
But says, I mean, now I'm looking at the language, and the sentence I think you're talking about is Deputy Grove had initiated the stop for traffic and equipment violations. It was likely that the defendant would have been cited and released at the conclusion of the stop and interaction with Deputy Grove, but for the discovery of the drugs and drug-related contraband. So, I mean, I don't, again, that's very similar to what I just said about the automobile exception. I mean, right? I mean, up until that point, had there not been, you know, and also like whether field sobriety testing would have led to the belief that there was a DWI or probable cause to arrest for the DWI. So I don't know that applying both of the exceptions here is a sort of legal error that would require us to reverse, but maybe you can explain why it might be. Or I don't know if that was the thrust of your argument.
Well, and I think it's kind of it's a little bit of a multifactorial thrust, Your Honor. I think there's a significant intermixing of factors here, and I think the district court kind of loses track of when each justification was present. And I think the district court adds in factors into, I mean, for example, the probable cause determination. It adds in factors that weren't present at the time it found that the probable cause exception was used. Okay, so my
What
direct point
factors are those,
here.
Mr. Dahlquist?
I'm sorry.
You said the district court added some factors, and I was just asking you which what did the district court add?
Well, what the district court, I think the district court, where their clear error lies is in finding that the probable cause exception was present. The district court credits the detection of the odor of marijuana into that probable cause determination. And while I'll concede that the deputy said that he did notice the odor of marijuana was only noticed once the search had already begun. So once the door was opened to search the vehicle, after Darlene was out with the deputies, that's when the odor of marijuana was detected. And so to use the probable cause exception to, which the court does, to initiate that search, to use
So
the
you're saying
finding.
the search started when he opened the door,
Yes.
and there was nothing before he opened the door. You know, for me, it was, well, I can only speak for myself, but you know, as soon as he stopped, he jumps out of his car with his hands up. I mean, that's a little suspicious to me. I mean, why shouldn't we factor that in? I mean, a lot of people, well, I don't know. That seems odd to me, and it
I
seems like
agree.
something that someone would do if they're under the influence of drugs.
I don't know if we can speculate exactly why Dowling did that, but I agree that it does strike one as a little bit odd. But I think if you take into consideration all the factors, the fact that he's pulled over
Well,
in the
where would
downtown.
we put in the factor? It's at some point I think someone testified that, you know, he was known to be a violent offender. I mean, first of all, is that right? Am I right about that?
There is a finding to that regard. There was statements in the Lothenbach packet that did state that. I know that the deputies did say that. I agree that that is in the
Well,
findings.
it, you know, it okay. And I know you have challenges about just the initial traffic stop, but assuming the traffic stop is valid, you know, he jumps out of the car, he's a known violent offender. At that point, why can't they search for weapons?
Well, I think part of the problem is he gets out of the car and they immediately direct him back into the car. And so at that point, why reintroduce him into that setting? I think there
Well, I
are
mean, I think
other.
that's because, well, okay, maybe that defies a little common sense because if they think he's got a gun in the car, why are they letting him go get it? But at the end of the day, I mean, normally don't they want to sort of, no, we don't want you standing outside, you know. What would you prefer they put him in their car?
I think it's always hard in a case like this. I'd like to answer just a couple pieces of
Sure.
that question, if I may. I agree that it does seem odd that he gets out of the car initially. I think it's important to note that he's in a parking lot. He's not on the side of the road, which it makes it a little bit of a different scenario. I think there isn't that same dangerousness to him. It's a very simple difference. He gets out of the car. There are two officers who are present when he gets out of the car. And the officers put him back in, and then but the door is open while he's inside the car. The district court didn't find that there were two officers present, but that is contained in the Lothenbach packet on page number 10, that Deputy Brekke as well saw him get out of the car with his arms up and talk to Dahlin. Now they both say that they know he's a violent offender. Whether or not they knew that initially or whether they found that after the fact, I don't know. But
Isn't the bigger problem for you here that, I mean, let's set aside the marijuana order. Let's say we agree with you on that, that as soon as law enforcement opens the door of the car and smells the marijuana, the search has already started. So we can't use something that happened after the search started to justify the search, or something that was observed. But you have what Judge Connolly pointed out, the jumping out with the hands up. You know, whether or not you would consider for the probable cause analysis the violent offender history for the automobile exception, you could argue that. But you also have that once he goes back in the car, he's making furtive movements, moving around as though he's grabbing something and moving something underneath the driver's seat. And then you have speaking quickly, pupils constricted, fidgety, mood inconsistent, which the deputy says in the Lothenbach packet are all signs of being under the influence of a controlled substance. Why isn't that enough to warrant a reasonably prudent person to believe that the vehicle contains contraband?
I think there's a couple points to that. One, the behavior when he gets out of the car is indicative of controlled substance consumption. And specifically, it's indicative of a stimulant consumption. The fidgety behavior, the constricted pupils, the mood lability, that's consistent with some type of a stimulant. The furtive movement, I do. It is a little bit problematic that the furtive movement is basically these officers have seized Dahlin, and they basically are sitting behind him and watching him. And like I said, there's two officers watching him, and he's got his door open.
Yeah, but I mean, not every encounter like this turns into a vehicle search, right? I mean, there's lots of cases where someone exhibits symptoms of being under the influence of a controlled substance or alcohol where the officers don't say there's PC to search the car. What makes this different, right, is that you have the jumping out right away, which indicates that he doesn't want them to go in the car. Then when they told him to go back in the car, he's moving around like he's trying to hide something in the car, and he looks like he's under the influence. So that's it, to me, what distinguishes this case from a normal DWI investigation. I don't, and then again, like Judge Connolly says, I'm speaking for myself, but maybe you can explain why those three factors, setting aside the criminal history, setting aside the marijuana order, why that's not enough for PC to search the car.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that distinguishes from a lot of other cases is there's no other indication of other criminal activity as well. In so many of the cases where they search the car, whether it's based on the weapon search or something like that, there's some other report of criminal behavior. I think it's also important that he does hop out of the car, but then he gets back in it, and in addition, he leaves the door open so that the officers can see what he's doing. So it's hard to. I always struggle a little bit with what's normal behavior and what's furtive movement. Those are two factors that I think there's a lot of discretion or interpretation on what furtive movement is. I mean, is furtive movement reaching to grab documentation or something like that, or is it moving everywhere? And it's
Do we
often
have to
turned on.
reweigh the evidence to question whether it's furtive movement? I mean, we had to have a cold record here that the district court construes and concludes that it's furtive, you know. So what can we as a court of appeals do with that?
The only additional factor I would say that the court doesn't seem to apply here is that Deputy Brekke's report doesn't support the furtive movement argument. He doesn't note that in his report. So you got a couple of different contradictions of officers that are contained in the Lothenbach report in the record. You've got the one
Well,
officer.
then that would have That would have been, had you had a live hearing, something to cross-examine about. But since you didn't, I mean, I don't think we can, make in. Well, I think there's nothing we can do about that. I mean, in my opinion.
The only thing is, I think that's a pretty it's a pretty direct contradiction. I agree. We didn't have a record. There's no cross-examination on that issue. But you have two officers who submitted reports of the same incident, and one really striking point is the one officer, Grove, says he's out there by himself calling dispatch and noticing this furtive movement. The other officer, Brecky, says he notices Dahleen get out of the vehicle with his hands up and doesn't notice any furtive movement. So that record does contain those two contradicting statements submitted in the report of the two officers. I agree. It was submitted as a Florence packet, and so we simply have that those documents with the in the record.
Thank you, Mr. Dahlquist. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. I'm Tanner Holton, appearing on behalf of the state here. I would like to start by just addressing one issue that's brought up in my brief and also in the appellant's reply brief. That's the waiver of the issue of the stop. I would note that in the appellant's reply brief, they indicate that the court has indicated there's no limitation on the scope of the motion. However, I believe at Index 16, if you look at the motion and the language that it uses, there is a limitation of the scope. And I'm quoting here, and it says the motion is for the motion to suppress is for any and all evidence obtained as a result of a stop, search, or seizure. And then it goes into more specifically, law enforcement failed to possess a requisite, and I think there's a word missing, a requisite something to conduct a warrantless search of defendant's motor vehicle. So I would argue that that in of itself is the limit of the motion. Even if the court determines that that issue is not waived, I would argue that Deputy Grove still possessed the reasonable suspicion to initiate the traffic stop, as was found by the lower court. This is indicated at index number 22, the Florence packet on pages 5 and 6. Deputy Grove noted that the taillights were barely illuminated, admittedly. He did not indicate whether or not those were discernible at 50 feet or any of the distances required under the various statutes. However, under Minnesota Statute 169.57, all stop and signal lights must be maintained in good working order. And I would argue that a taillight being barely illuminated violates that statute. In addition, Your Honor, and I would note this is after Deputy Grove turned on his emergency lights, Mr. Dahlin did fail to signal his left-hand turn from Main Avenue onto 2nd Street.
Do you agree that Mr. Dahleen was seized at the point that the deputy turned on his lights?
I think he likely would be considered seized at that point. I agree with Mr. Dahlquist's
So how
memorandum.
could we use the fact of the failure to signal as a support for the reason to seize him when it occurred after the seizure?
That would be a stretch, Your Honor. I would agree that I don't know that it could be used. I just thought that I would bring it up in case someone had a different opinion on it. But I agree that I don't think that could be used as the basis for the stop.
Thank you.
Third, moving into the different searches that were conducted and why they were conducted, I agree wholeheartedly with the comments and the questions of the court. First and foremost, Mr. Dahleen's history as a violent offender, which Deputy Grove noted, his odd or unique behaviors of exiting the vehicle immediately, making furtive movements, returning to the vehicle and collecting or moving something. And I would note returning to the vehicle at direction of law enforcement, but him moving things under his seat, talking fast, fidgeting. All of these seem to support Deputy Grove's concern that he may have a weapon in his possession and that he may be armed and dangerous. As is indicated by the district court, at this point, Deputy Grove is investigating a minor traffic offense. get his every intent, as is noted in his reports, that he was going to release him at the conclusion of this traffic investigation, and that he was just conducting this traffic investigation for the minor traffic violations he originally noted. If the court were to determine that that grounds for the warrantless search of the vehicle is not appropriate, I would also argue that the probable cause exception is further support for this search. As was discussed by some of the questions already, I think Deputy Grove had an abundance of evidence indicating that Mr. Dahleen may have been in violation of driving while impaired laws, or had in his possession some sort of controlled substance, given that he immediately exited the vehicle, was making those furtive movements, and all the other indicators that Deputy Grove noted in his report and have been noted today during oral arguments.
Do you agree that we shouldn't consider the odor of marijuana, since that was detected after the door was opened by the deputy?
I would agree with that as well, Your Honor. I think that the search likely occurred when Deputy Grove opened the car door. And that's when, in reviewing the reports, that's when Deputy Grove noted the odor of marijuana. So I agree with that as well.
Can I ask you, jumping back to the protective sweep argument, and thank you for your candor about that. I wanted to ask, would you agree? I mean, one of the arguments your counterpoint makes is that Mr. Dahleen's not in the car at that point. He's away from the vehicle. Would you agree that, I mean, this is hypothetically, these aren't our facts, but there is a point at which, like, for example, had Mr. Dahleen been placed under arrest and was in the back seat of the car, where there's a limit to the protective sweep doctrine being used as a ground to search the vehicle, if there is no possibility in the circumstance of Mr. Dahleen being under arrest that he can return to the vehicle, or that the vehicle has been impounded and is taken to the impound lot and the suspect is nowhere near the vehicle. You couldn't use protective sweep in those circumstances, right?
I agree wholeheartedly, Your Honor. I think if there's no chance for him to get to any areas where a weapon may be contained, I don't think the protective sweep doctrine works. Here, there's a concern that Mr. Dahleen both had a weapon on himself, which is, in my opinion, likely why the officer told him to get back in his car, because him being in his car adds a further obstacle for him to pull out a weapon and potentially use it. But there was also that concern that there was a weapon in the vehicle as well, which I understand is a little counterintuitive, telling him to get back into the vehicle. But I would note they did search Mr. Dahleen. They did a search of his body to make sure there wasn't weapons there. Oddly enough, initially a weapon was not found, but one was found later, just with a more thorough search. But that's besides the point. And I guess for the reasons that I've talked about, I would ask that the court affirm the lower court's decisions. I would welcome any court's questions at this time.
Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Holton. Mr. Dahlquist, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I want to just point out a couple of things. I know I addressed the waiver issue in my reply brief. I think that issue is without merit. I know that the motion did make a general suppression motion and then specified some additional grounds. I don't think that's a waiver. More, in addition to that, at the hearing, no waiver was sought or given of any issues. The parties did brief that issue. The court did devote 4 pages of its order to that issue. So clearly that was adequately addressed and not waived. One additional thing that I think I would just point out as well is that in this instance, it seems clear from the facts that upon interacting with the officers that Dahleen was suspected of being under the influence. I think the progression of that would have been field sobriety testing and ultimately being arrested. He was further in the control of the two officers who were present, and they had already Terry searched him at the time of the additional search into the car. So in light of those factors, I would agree he was not going to be returned to the vehicle.
But you agree he wasn't under arrest.
I agree he was not under arrest yet. But it's almost as if, in my opinion, the officers paused what was that progression just to be able to search the vehicle. I think given what they use for justification, which are would all be used for justification for field sobriety testing and for invocation of either the breath test advisory or to get a warrant, which is ultimately what they did for testing for a stimulant, they kind of pause it to try to still give themselves grounds to go arrest or go search the vehicle.
But if we're going to speculate, couldn't we just as easily speculate that what if they had found nothing in the vehicle? What if he had passed field sobriety tests and then they just cite him for a bad taillight and release him? Then why would that have prevented them from the protective sweep doctrine in this case?
And I think I would say it's more than speculation here. I mean, it's clear from the factors in the record that they were noticing indicia of being under the influence. And they pivot. And the court does credit that for PC. They do credit that as part of the finding supporting the automobile exception as well. So I agree. It's a bit speculative, but it's not out of nowhere speculation, I think is an inarticulate way for me to put it. I apologize.
But isn't this where so now the tension seems to be working against you, like we talked about at the beginning, between PC and protective sweep? Because if we presume that he was going to be arrested, then we would presume probable cause. And why wouldn't that support their use of the automobile exception? Because you agree that you need to prevail on both of those exceptions in order to win on appeal, right?
I agree with that. On that, I have to prevail on both. I don't necessarily. So,
Mr. Dahlquist, what time of day did this happen at?
It was just after 8 p.m.
Okay. So was it dark?
It's early April. So yeah, I think it would have been after sunset.
Thank you.
And so if I'm just going to go back to Justice Eddy's question a little bit, it definitely seems like the court credits so much the indication of intoxication and uses that for justification for search. I think if he would have been arrested, it's hard to get to that point for PC at this point, like a search incident to the arrest, because there isn't that finding at this point in the court record. I wanted to point out one really brief thing as well. I know that Mr. Holton pointed out that Mr. Dahleen was subject to a weapon search when he initially came out of the car, and he characterized the finding of a knife later on as a weapon. I always just want to clarify that a knife obviously can be a weapon, but it can also just be a common tool used for opening boxes and things like that. There's no indication in this other than the behavior that Mr. Dahleen was otherwise threatening or doing anything of that nature, either to the officers or prior to his stop in the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dahlquist. Thank you, Mr. Holton. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days.